Again, remember on Tuesdays we begin a little earlier because we end a little earlier because of Rabbi Wasserman. Excuse me. Anyway, we're in, of course, the Parshios of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And it's very, very interesting. If you look at the Haggadah, Pesach is late this year because it's a leap year. There is a line in the Haggadah that's a very, very significant line. In fact, it might be the topic sentence of the Haggadah of Pesach. Chayav Adam Liros Esatzmo. A person is obligated to view himself ki'ilu hu yatsa mimitzrayim, as if you yourself were taken out of Egypt. You're not only commemorating the past, you're not only thinking about what happened, but spiritually, a person has to look at it like a present reality, that God is taking me out of Egypt. And the question is exactly, what does that mean? I was not in Egypt. I do see that there are ads. You can take a bus trip to Egypt if you're interested. In fact, I once saw years ago, although it sounds a little strange, bizarre, that they were even planning a Pesach program in Egypt. So go to Egypt for Pesach. Unless they couple it with the Red Sea on the seventh day, I don't hear it. Maybe go to Egypt and leave, you know, whatever. But we were not slaves. How can, in other words, I can be grateful for what Hashem did in the past, but how can I experience it as a present reality? So there are two interpretations, basically. One interpretation, which the Rambam seems to say, is it is a form of what you might call, Lahavdil, Lee Strasberg method acting. By that I mean, the Rambam says, you use your power of imagination to make believe you were a slave, to feel the whip on your back, to feel the oppression, to feel the degradation, to emotionally imagine what slavery was like, and then you feel the joy of God's emancipation. Which means it is an exercise of emotionally trying to re-experience a past moment in order that it should become more real to you, and then you appreciate it, right? You know, that's the theory of method acting, in which you kind of literally imagine yourself in that role. That is one view. But the Sifrei Chassidus give a different and maybe a deeper view into how we understand.
Yeah. Was that the Ramban or Rambam?
Rambam, Maimonides. That's what Maimonides seems to say. It's a notion of a method acting type of thing. The Sifrei Chassidus, the Sfas Emes, says a deeper interpretation, I think. And he says it really focuses on the meaning of the term Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim, of course, means Egypt. It was a nation. It was a people. Again, not to be confused with the modern Egyptians, but there were ancient Egyptians. But Mitzrayim is also connected etymologically to the word for constraints, limitations, blockages. In the Psalms, in Hallel, David HaMelech says, Min HaMeitzar Karasi Ka. I call out to God from the narrow, confining straits for God to give me expansiveness. Seen in this way, Mitzrayim is both a country, a nation, a particular culture, but it's a metaphor for everything in our lives that block us, that constrict us, that prevent us from connecting to God and realizing our potential and connecting to each other. That is also a Mitzrayim. And as the saying goes, sometimes it's easier to take the Jew out of Mitzrayim than it is to take Mitzrayim out of the Jew. Each of us has an inner Mitzrayim. We can be enslaved by arrogance, by depression, by selfishness, by anger. These are inner enslavements. You know, you may have heard of the actor Mr. T. I don't know if he's still alive or working. I don't know what it is. But I usually do not quote him on matters of Torah. But he once said something that was actually a very profound remark, albeit perhaps unintentionally. And you know, his persona was he wears a lot of gold chains. So he was once asked why he wears gold chains. So listen to what he said. He said, I wear chains to emulate my ancestors who came to this country in chains, the African slaves. The difference was their chains were around their legs, my chains are around the neck. Their chains were iron, my chains are gold. But he said, I'm doing just like they did, I'm wearing chains. Now that is actually quite a brilliant remark. Because what he's saying is, you can be a slave in a lot of different ways. You can be a slave that is tied up in chains, being beaten by a taskmaster. Or you can be a slave to the rat race, to Hollywood success, to affluence, to power, to hedonism. That's a slavery too. And just because somebody is not beating you over the back, that's a slavery that is within. And the slavery that's within is a much bigger slavery than the slavery that's outside of you. It's harder to get rid of. It's harder to be liberated. And this is the word Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is that which constricts me, that which limits me, that which enslaves me. So here is the thing. In Judaism, spiritual phenomena repeat themselves over and over and over again. Meaning, Yetzias Mitzrayim was not just a physical event. Rather, it represented the release of a spiritual energy from God that enables us to re-experience our own liberation from Mitzrayim over and over and over again. So the Baal HaTanya writes, indeed, and again, others will elaborate on it later, that the idea that each person must regard himself as if they themselves were taken out of Mitzrayim means I tap into the energy that the Almighty put into the world at the time of the Exodus of Egypt, and that energy is there, particularly around Pesach time, and I should add, when these parshios about the Exodus are being, we actually experience a miniature Pesach during these weeks, that the power of Yetzias Mitzrayim enables me to be liberated from whatever it is that enslaves me. So we have to identify, what is my enslaver? What am I a slave to? What is blocking me? What is holding me back? And then I turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu can liberate me. But I have to want to be liberated. I have to be ready to be liberated. I have to seize that moment. See what the Baal HaTanya is saying? Each person must regard himself as if they are taken out of Mitzrayim. It's not, like the Rambam says, simply imagining I was actually a slave in Egypt. But rather, to identify my Mitzrayim and know that the spiritual power that Hashem unleashed, I can tap into and become liberated, as it were. Okay, so very, very profound. So Yetzias Mitzrayim. Now, again, I want to be very clear about the one maybe obvious point, but I don't want Chas V'Shalom people to get confused. You sometimes see in non-halachic movements an expression of an idea that Yetzias Mitzrayim is a myth; it really didn't happen, and it represents a metaphor for human liberation and the realization of human potential. Now, stated in that way, that is apikorsis, that is heresy, we certainly believe, it is a cornerstone of our faith, that the Jews were slaves in Egypt, that there were 10 plagues, there was the splitting of the Red Sea, that God liberated our forefathers from slavery. That is absolutely true. It is literally true. It is not a metaphoric truth. It is a literal truth. However, truth is not limited to the literal, meaning, yes, it is a literal truth, but the literal fact as it played out in the ground is symbolic of spiritual forces that God put into the world. And those forces didn't just exist then. Those forces exist now. And that is how I tap into them. So we're not saying, God forbid, that the Exodus story is a metaphor. Rather, it is literally true, but it is metaphorical at the same time, because it's in its literalness, it represents a symbolic opening up of the gates that we tap into at every time. Okay? Which means spiritual phenomena are not bounded by time or place. They are eternal realities that exist in the universe that may be precipitated by historical events. But the historical events opened a gateway, and that gateway is still with us. And that's what the Baal HaTanya writes. Each person must regard himself as if they themselves were taken out of Mitzrayim. Okay, Mitzrayim in the sense of Meitzar, that which limits me. In fact, it's very, very interesting. Let me talk a minute about the calendar. You guys either have the good fortune or the bad fortune, depending on how you look at it, that your Zman until Pesach is a month longer than usual. Now hopefully you rejoice in the extra month you have to learn Torah. If you're not yet rejoicing, Be'ezras Hashem, I give you a bracha that you should rejoice. We always do Cheskas, we usually do Cheskas Abatim during these long Zman, because it's such a long perek, so it's hopefully, you know, it's a good for a longer Zman. Now, why is the year longer this year? Because we have what is called a leap year. And how often do we have leap years? Pretty often. In a 19-year cycle, we have seven out of 19, so it's approaching half, are leap years. Now, a leap year, as you know, is not just adding a day like February 29, but we Jews do everything in excess. We add a whole month, and that month is the second month of Adar. Actually, technically, it's the first month of Adar that's the added month, actually. In other words, the second Adar is the real month of Adar, and Adar Sheni is that extra... I'm sorry, Adar Rishon is that extra month. We add a month. Now, why is that so? Why do we add a leap year? Why is that so important? So there are halachic reasons why the calendar is built into a leap year. And here's our problem. Our problem is that the Jewish calendar is a lunar-based calendar, meaning a year equals 12 revolutions of the moon around the earth. This is a lunar calendar. It's not a solar calendar. Now, a lunar year is only 354 days. A solar year, which is the rotation or the revolution of the earth around the sun, is, I can be approximate, that's good enough, is 365. I know it's not exact, but we can work with that. So that means a lunar year is 11 days shorter than a solar year, right? 12 lunar revolutions is 11 days less than the revolution of the earth around the sun. That means, in any given year, again, I'm simplifying it a little bit, if you take a Hebrew date and an English date, the next year the Hebrew date is going to be around 11 days earlier. So let's take in any given year, let's say that April 1st is Rosh Chodesh Nisan. In the next year, Rosh Chodesh Nisan will be March, 17th. And the next year, it'll be March, 11 days earlier, March 6th. Now, what's going to eventually happen is, therefore, that a holiday that started in the spring is eventually going to be moved earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier till it'll be in the winter. And then eventually it'll get back again, but it'll move throughout the different seasons. The seasons are based on the solar year. Spring, summer, winter, fall. That is the problem that our neighbors across the street, our good buddies across the street, face, because the Islamic calendar is also a lunar calendar. And as a result, any Islamic holiday can be any season of the year. It can float. Now, that is a big problem with Ramadan, because Ramadan is their month of fasting. And I guess when Ramadan is in the winter, life is relatively sweet because the day is short. When Ramadan is in a hot summer, and it's not going to be nightfall till after 8 o'clock, the natives get a little testy. But of course, they don't need that excuse. They take all sorts of excuses to do whatever they do. Now, why isn't the Jewish calendar like the Islamic calendar? Because the Torah insists that Pesach must be celebrated in the beginning of the springtime season. So whenever it gets too early, meaning too close to winter or into the winter, we have to push it forward a whole month by adding an extra month. That pushes Pesach a month later into the spring. And then the next year it creeps up earlier, 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 push it forward. Right, so that's what leap years do. Leap years fundamentally coordinate the solar calendar and the lunar calendar to ensure that Pesach will fall during the spring. Right? The danger is that Pesach eventually would get moved into the winter. We have to have this adjustment. So technically, therefore, the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar with a solar adjustment. It is not a pure solar calendar, it is a lunar calendar. And that's why Rosh Hashanah, any Jewish holiday will not be the same as the English day. But when it gets too out of whack, we have to have an adjustment. The Islamic calendar is also a lunar calendar, but without the solar adjustment. Right? You understand that's the concept of a leap year. And in the time of the temple, Rosh Chodesh was determined by witnesses. Now it's all been worked into the calendar system itself. So we don't need ad hoc. The Sanhedrin used to make an ad hoc decision, should we have a leap year or not. Today there's no ad hoc decision making. It's built into the actual framework. Although it's interesting that the Jewish calendar only goes until the year 6000, because we have a promise that Mashiach will come no later than the year 6000. So we will go back to the old system of witnesses and the Sanhedrin making a determination. Which actually means the following fascinating point, which is not going to happen, but if God forbid Mashiach would not come by the year 6000, right now we're 5776. Okay, so 6000 is not so far away. If Chas v'Shalom Mashiach does not come by the year 6000, which again, Mashiach will come, but I'm just raising a hypothetical. The Jewish calendar expires. Now, do you know what it means to say a calendar expires? That means there will still be Shabbos, because Shabbos does not depend on a calendar date. Shabbos is the seventh day, but there will not be any Yom Tovim. There will not be Pesach, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, because all of them depend on a calendar based on Rosh Chodesh, the new moon. And if there is no official proclamation of the new moon or a calendar that has determined that, then essentially you never turn into the new year. I mean, you're still in your old year that goes on and on and on and on forever, and there are no holidays. So, now again, as I say, that's not going to happen. But just as a theoretical hypothetical, there would actually not be Yom Tovim without a calendar. Yeah. There would not be Purim either. The statement of the Gemara that all the holidays will be nullified except Purim is not referring to the scenario that I talked about where the calendar runs out. It's just referring to the fact that when Mashiach comes, that's another discussion. Some of the holidays may not be necessary. because they talk about miracles and we'll see God's presence, but Purim will still be there. But in the running out of the calendar is a different contingency, and that would even cover Purim, because after all, Purim is the 14th, or in Yerushalayim, the 15th of Adar. If there's no calendar, there's no Adar. So you don't have the, you've never hit the date, so you're not going to have Purim either. Okay. So the question I want to raise with you, and this is going to be connected to the Baal HaTanya, is why is it so important that Pesach be in the spring? Yeah, it's true that the year that they left Egypt, it happened to have been in the spring, but we're celebrating a Jewish date. If the Jewish date is the 15th of Nisan, so whenever that is, we celebrate Pesach. What's the big deal that you change the whole calendar and you add a month to the year and you push off Pesach by a month, which is pretty amazing? You'll be eating chametz dekahamintashen, when really, this should be the time that you're not allowed to have bread at all. You're celebrating Purim with all the chametz, when it's really Pesach. But we change everything, because we got to have Pesach in the spring. Like, why is that so important? So the Maharal of Prague says the following idea. He says that Pesach is not just about commemorating an event. Rather, it represents the infusion of the spiritual energy of redemption that God puts into the world. And he says that spiritual energy even affects the physical earth. Think about spring. Spring is actually symbolic of rejuvenation, redemption. The ground is released from the dormancy and the enslavement of the winter. It's now able to grow. Flowers are growing, plants are growing, trees are blossoming. But why? Why is the earth responding? Because the power of redemption is in the world. So here is the point. If Pesach's Hebrew date is not during the spring, that energy is not in the world yet. So we have to push off Pesach to correspond with the energy of freedom and liberation and inner redemption that is being released. Because you're not just, see, if you would be just commemorating an event, so the only thing that would be important is the date of the event. The date is a Hebrew date. So whenever that Hebrew date is when we celebrate. But if you're not looking at it as the commemoration of an event, but as a re-experiencing of the powers that Hashem put into the world, then you got to look at the earth for when those powers are here. When it's spring, that means those powers are here. You see? Now, you may ask a question, well, wait a second, that's not quite true. Anyone here from the southern hemisphere? Australia, South America? Okay. Hey, it's not spring. Pesach is not in the spring. And why do we celebrate Pesach down under when it's not the spring? The short answer is that the spiritual powers enter the world not through New York even, but they enter the world through Yerushalayim. And therefore, when it's spring here, then the spiritual powers of redemption even go to Australia and South America and the like. So it makes no difference what season it is where you live, unless you live here. It only makes a difference what season it is here. And when it's spring here, the power comes into the world. Yeah.
Are those spiritual powers stronger than the nefesh and the neshama?
They are powers that our neshama absorbs. Mm-hmm. Yes, they absorb them. But on the other hand, we wouldn't always be aware of it. We need to kind of observe it from the outside. And then I see these powers. Now again, like anything else Hashem gives you, Shabbos, you know, and any gift that enhances the neshama, these are potentialities. Things don't happen automatically. And one needs to work, one needs to think, one needs to learn, one needs to pray, one needs to open your heart to receive the gifts. Otherwise, they're like in sealed packages. If you don't take the medicine, then it's not going to work. But there is that great, great liberation of the spirit. Now, we're not in Pesach right now, but again, I want to make the point. that the parshiot of Shmos, Vayera, right, these are the parshiot of Yetzias Mitzrayim. This also allows us to experience the redemptive power of the Exodus in Zer Anpin, in what is called microcosm and the like. So this is kind of a mini Pesach time, right? The Alter Rebbe used to have a saying, people say, this was during the beginning of the so-called Enlightenment where, and the Reform Movement and the like, so people say a Jew has to live with the times. People often say that as a reason not to be religious. Why be religious? Live with the times. So the Alter Rebbe, the Valtanya, used to say, I also say, live with the times, meaning I live with the Parsha of the week, meaning that the Parsha that's being read that week, which changes from week to week, is the particular spiritual lesson that I try to take into my neshama and the like. Okay, so this is the idea of Mitzrayim, of identifying your inner Mitzrayim. And again, we'll have occasion to talk about this quite a lot. But I want to mention one thing about this. When we ask ourselves, why were the Jews enslaved in Mitzrayim? Why do we have this story? Why did this happen to us? What was the purpose of all of this? So there are a few different preliminary thoughts that people say. There is a Gemara in Maseches Nedarim that sees the servitude in Egypt, and this is a very difficult Gemara, as a punishment for the sin of Avraham Avinu. What sin did Avraham Avinu commit? So the Gemara gives no fewer than three possibilities. Possibility one, which is the best known, the best one Rashi brings in Chumash, is that when God made a covenant with Avraham, that I'm giving the land to your children. So Avram said, "Bama eda, how do I know that they will get the land? Can you give me proof?" And that's when God told him about the 400 years of exile. So Chazal see in this statement, "Give me proof," on some level a lack of faith in the Almighty's promise. And it was that lack of faith that resulted in the need for an Egyptian exile to purify us ourselves of a lack of faith. That is reason number one. Again, it's very, very difficult to say that about Avraham Avinu, because the Torah itself praises Avraham Avinu precisely because of his great faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I mean, that's what the Torah singles out as the praise of Avraham Avinu. And yet Chazal say the question, Bama Eda, which is in Parshas Lech Lecha, was a troublesome question. The Gemara then gives a second possible sin, and that is, do you remember his nephew Lot was captured by the five kings? I'm sorry, by the four more powerful kings, and Avram made a raid. Avram assembled people, and he rescued his nephew Lot, as well as defeating the four kings. So apparently he used Torah scholars. He used people who were studying Torah. He drafted them into his army. That's interesting. Potential controversy. The Gemara says it was wrong of him to use Talmidei Chachamim, his scholars of the Torah, for a military action, even though it is a matter of saving Lot's life. Asa Angaria. Angaria is like military service. B'talmidei Chachamim. And the third Avera, the Gemara says, is the aftermath of that. That after Avraham Avinu defeated the four kings, and he captured many, many people from the opposing army, so the king of Sodom, now remember, Sodom was on Avraham's side at that point, said to him, "Give me the prisoners, give me my people back, and you can keep all the spoils of the war." And Avram declined to keep any of the spoils, because Avram said, "I want God to make me wealthy. I don't want any person to say I made Avram wealthy." Remember, he turned down the spoils, but he did release all of the captives of war back to the five kings. The Talmud says that was a mistake. He should have kept those prisoners as his own, because that way he could have been makarev them to worship Hashem, instead of releasing them back into this immoral and decadent and evil society. Okay, so the Gemara Nedarim gives three different reasons for the servitude of Egypt. One was Abraham's apparent lack of emunah, b'ma'idah. The second was he used Talmidei Chachamim in a military action. And the third is, in his generosity, in not taking anything as a result of the war, he relinquished custody and control of people that he potentially could have brought tachas kanfei hashchina. This is a Gemara in the Nedarim. We will come back to this. The obvious question you're going to raise is, well, okay, whatever Avraham did that was wrong, whatever that was, why should generations of his descendants suffer slavery for 210 years? Is there not a principle that you don't punish children for the sins of their fathers, etc.? And why would the punishment be so severe? But you do have to understand that even though it's a general rule, we don't punish children because of the sins of parents, when you're dealing with even the smallest mistakes of our patriarchs, that does have devastating consequences. And let me give you an example, because they are the root of everything that we are. So if something is even a little bit off, it's like a cancerous cell. In the course of hundreds and hundreds of years, it's going to be magnified and spread, and even the smallest little deviation can turn into a horrendous distortion. And therefore it needs to be corrected, like a tiny cancerous cell. God forbid, keeps on growing and growing and growing. If you're building a bridge from two sides, and you start off a tenth of an inch off track, by the time you reach the middle, you know, the two halves are going to be, you know, 50 feet apart. It does a little mistake. So everything about the Avos, the smallest little mistakes, have to be corrected, or the Jewish people will not be able to survive in the course of time. Have to be perfect. The Abarbanel, you know, the Abarbanel is a very interesting parish. I don't know if I've spoken about him before. This is, I'll mention a little biographical information. This is Rav Yitzchak Abarbanel, who also goes by the name Don Yitzchak Abarbanel, because he was a member of the Spanish nobility. He was the finance minister under Ferdinand and Isabella. And he was the finance minister of Spain at the very time of the Spanish Inquisition and the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492. He was given permission to stay in Spain and remain a religious Jew, because he was needed for his financial acumen. He did refuse, and he went into exile with everybody else. But he was a great author, in addition to being a very, very skilled politician and a brilliant finance minister. In fact, he was the one who raised the money for Columbus going to the New World. They didn't know it was the New World, but Columbus's expedition supposedly to India, which turned out to be to the Americas. But in addition, he wrote biblical commentaries, very, very long commentaries on the Chumash, on the Nevi'im. He did not write on the Ksuvim, except for the Book of Daniel. And he has a very unique style. He takes a chapter of the Chumash, and he will ask many, many questions, maybe 50 questions. And then he will explain it to answer all of the questions. So the joke they tell about the Abarbanel is, a person was studying the Abarbanel, he became an apikoros. How did he become an apikoros? Because he used to like to read the Abarbanel after eating cholent Shabbos morning. So he would sit in his chair, and he would read 50 contradictions on the Chumash, 50 questions that don't make sense, and then he fell asleep because he ate the cholent. So he says, How can I believe? There's so many kashas on the Torah, so many questions. So if you're going to read the Abarbanel, be sure that you read the answers as well as the questions. Otherwise, you know, you'll think there are too many unresolved contradictions about the Torah. But the Abarbanel has a different approach than the Gemara itself, which is interesting. The Abarbanel looks at Yetzias Mitzrayim as a punishment for the sale of Yosef, because after all, it all works out. They sold Yosef into slavery. So Hashem basically says, you and your children will have to experience the enslavement that you put your brother Yosef through. In other words, the Rabbanel simply says that you connect the Mitzrayim to the Mechiras Yosef itself. But there's an obvious question in the Abarbanel, because Yosef's own children were slaves in Egypt. I mean, if you're looking at the sale as a punishment for what the tribes did in selling Yosef, one might have thought that Yosef's progeny, who obviously were the victims, they should not be punished because their grandfather was sold into slavery. Right? So that's a problem with the Abarbanel. So far we've mentioned two approaches, at least superficially, the Gemara in the Nedarim and the Abarbanel, and each of them have problems. So the approach we will talk about tomorrow is that we see in slavery that there was an essential characteristic that the Jewish people needed to acquire that could only have been acquired through that slavery. So it was not so much a punishment. Instead of saying, oh, there was a sin and there had to be a punishment, it was a necessary stage in the spiritual evolution and growth of the Jewish nation that they needed this type of formative experience. Okay, that'll be the Mahalach, and we'll try to talk about that tomorrow. So have a good day.